So 25 years after the original Space Jam comes out, Space Jam A New Legacy comes out on a Friday afternoon in 2021, between the two GOATs, MJ and LeBron. I will say that I watched it. I did not get to finish it, unfortunately, which goes against every ounce of my personal rule book, because I hate not finishing movies. I just ran out of time and I didn't get to finish it. But it was all right. I will say it was pretty heavily reliant on you having seen the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of like references to that, and the Toon Squad is basically just like in this new one. It was just like they all like show up and like they go pick everyone up and they're like, all right, we got the band back together, and like no introductions at all. But it's fine if you've seen the first one. But and there were a few funny bits. I don't know. It's like definitely it's rated PG, so it's like a kids movie.
Sure.
And it's weird. LeBron is definitely not an actor.
No kidding.
And I was really thrown off because it like the plot is based around his family, and it's not his real family. Like his wife showed up, and I was like, wait, I don't think that is LeBron's wife. I was super thrown off.
Is it MJ's real family in the original?
I am not sure that MJ's family makes an appearance in the original.
Well, I know his family is in the movie. Like, they're at his home for part of it. I don't know if it's actually his family or not.
I'm not totally sure. But the... Yeah, I was just throwing for a loop. The kids, like, one of the kids is, like, the main character. And I was like, I'm pretty confident that that is not LeBron's kid. which is fine. You know, it was just... unexpected.
Sure.
And there are a few funny bits, like I said, but I guess I'll report back on the last half hour of it. But
I do want to say I'm reading about the movie right now. It currently has 38% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is lower than the original's 44%.
Yikes.
But it's still fresh. I just want to say this. It has a budget of $161 million.
Oh my
that is
God.
That is a larger budget than so Dunkirk, much. Which we were talking about today.
Oh my gosh, that's such a large budget.
It's a very large budget. I don't know what the money would do. Probably always paying LeBron.
Yeah, probably. And I will say that Don Cheadle was the villain.
Okay.
And it was like, it's so weird. Like, Don Cheadle is not a villain character at all. He was like this algorithm, like this physical embodiment of an algorithm.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it's kind of dumb. And just like him being a villain, I just couldn't get on page with it.
Well, I don't know if I'll watch it. I love the first one. I watched it so much as a kid on VHS, but I mean, I guess someday I'll watch it, but interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like I told Michael before we started recording that I told one of my friends that I was watching it, and just immediately, without saying anything else, he was like, MJ's better. Like, I hate how much of it has turned into a
just LeBron
versus MJ, whatever.
But this wasn't...
You know, I'm going to be honest. I'm a little conflicted on my LeBron versus MJ debate. I think I like LeBron more because he brought a championship to the great state of Ohio. But at the same time, I think I respect MJ more, mm-hmm. like, as a better player, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm. But. Gotcha.
Not that anyone cares at all.
I have no say. I have no say in this. But, yeah, I mean, nothing else really to report. I wanted to say, I guess on the topic of the 90s and the original Space Jam, I did want to say I woke up this morning to a text from our guest today, actually, about Biz Markie passing away. The rapper Biz Markie, Just a Friend.
And yes.
I don't know. I was sad. Age 57, just for some health reasons, and it's crazy. And
yeah,
I was reading about him, and he's known as the Clown Prince of rap because he was so like goofy in his songs, but he actually was really instrumental in like he was in a lawsuit over sampling a song in his music, which obviously tons of rappers do, but he was like the first to ever get in a lawsuit over it, and so now it's like the legal system for getting samples and making sure it's covered legally is completely changed because of him.
Interesting.
So, but yeah, I mean, just a friend, so great and iconic, and yeah,
that's great. Yeah. May he rest in peace.
Absolutely, absolutely. But yeah, without further ado, we're just going to cut to the break, and we'll be right back with Dunkirk and introducing our guest. All right, welcome back to End of the Stuff podcast. Today we are discussing from 2017, Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk. Sorry about that thunder there.
Whoa, you guys are hitting that at home. Hey, it's all right. That's happening with me too. So
okay, got it. It's like we're in the same place again. But yeah, we have once again a special guest this week. We're thinking about having him on a couple weeks ago talking about Spielberg, but he thought he'd rather talk about Dunkirk, which I think is his favorite Christopher Nolan movie. And so, yes, without further ado, Samuel Perron. Hey.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm Michael's older brother. I don't know if I'm the oldest guest on the podcast ever, 25. but I'm working as a freelance production assistant right now in Dallas. And one of your y'all's day one fans, I listen every week. And,
absolutely.
Really happy to be here. Just like Cole last week, I had some jitters this morning. I woke up ready to pod. I've been looking forward to this, so thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely, absolutely. We are, it is more nerve-wracking for me too. I don't know about you, Aiden, but I know last week was like Cole, but even I was expecting it to be more at ease with my brother on this week, but I was like, no, it has to be a great podcast because we have a guest on, so.
Yeah, I think the big thing is that neither of us have met each other's brother before, yeah. And so it was like I was nervous because I haven't met Sam before, and so I was worried about that dynamic, and you were worried about meeting Cole because you haven't met him before. But I think also it's just a matter of presenting a family member that you trust with an open mic. But
I think it does help that I've been listening to the podcast for so long. You know, it's not like I think if I had never heard your voice or listened to the pod before, that'd be a little bit more nerve wracking. But you know,
sure,
y'all are in my life every week. You know, every Tuesday. So there's some familiarity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's go.
Awesome. All right. Well, it's exciting. Yeah. I'll just introduce the movie real quick. It was my choice. This is, by the way, last movie of the season. In the coming weeks, we're going to come out with an episode. Aiden, I have to talk to you about some scheduling things. But
yeah
we're going to come out with an episode like the Oscars of the award show of the movies we've done so far in the season. Best actor, best director, actress, all that. And ranking our favorite movies and what we think is
just
best.
Have a little bit of fun, you know what I'm
absolutely
saying?
For the end of the season. But yeah, last movie, like I said before, is Dunkirk, 2017. Christopher Nolan directed, cinematography by my favorite, Hoyte van Hoytema, Swedish cinematographer. As I said before, Samuel's favorite Nolan movie. My favorite Nolan movie as well. Let's dive right in. Samuel, opening thoughts, then we'll go to Aiden.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. This is probably the Nolan movie that I've seen maybe the most, which is kind of crazy because it's one of his more recent ones.
Right.
Other than, you know, maybe Batman Begins or Dark Knight. It's definitely this one, and it's unlike any other war movie as well, which is kind of interesting to me. Because, you know, Dunkirk itself was considered, you know, a failure as far as, you know, during the war, but it was still a success to, you know, obviously evacuate all their soldiers. And even if you, whether or not you go into the movie knowing the story or not, it still unfolds very well. And really, they say, you know, at the end, you know, it's a story about survival and how survival is a victory. And there are different points, I'm sure we'll get into it later, where just the will to survive really comes out and shows in different ways throughout the characters. And I think that's, you know, it's a beautiful movie, too. There's some really breathtaking, you know, shots, especially with the Spitfires in the air over the ocean. But I don't know, just first thoughts, you know, it moves really well. You know, he kind of has a hold on your heart the whole time with the music too. You know, he kind of dictates the pace so well. So definitely my favorite of his movies, you know, of a director who I really enjoy. So high praise for me. I really love this movie.
Wow, very high praise. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I am not a huge war film guy. Just like have never really gotten into the genre too much. But I will say this one was actually like really solid, really, really good film. Christopher Nolan and Hans Zimmer, powerful duo, back at it again. Yeah. Just absolutely, I'm pretty sure they won an Oscar for sound editing for this film.
Mm-hmm.
It was like absolutely incredible. The sound editing mixed with the music soundtrack, it was just like I felt like there was never a moment of silence in the film. It was just so well put together, and all the attention to detail and all the noises that can happen like in a war film, I guess. It was just all super incredible. Storytelling was off the charts good. There was basically like there's about no dialogue in the film, or really like, I mean, we learned some stuff about some of the characters, but like nothing that really is crazily important, like, if that makes sense. Obviously dialogue is important or else you wouldn't have it in there, but I just felt like cinematography by itself was telling the story, and it was telling it super, super well. And like the title cards that come up, the I forget what the thing was called. I was reading about it online. The mole and the other ones. I'm bad with remembering stuff.
The air was the other one with the
The 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour, mm-hmm. And how all of those kind of meet up at one point. And just flipping back and forth, you know exactly where you are whenever it flips, and it was so tied together so well. And the convergence of all three of them coming together was really brilliant. Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge, superhero junkie, so I don't know that, feel like some of the Dark Knight movies might overtake this one for me in the Nolan book, but, it was still really, really solid.
And those are, I mean, that's, there's no shame in that because those are like in the top four for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, what both of you guys said, I agree with. I think that so much props to this movie for having such little dialogue. The first expositional piece of dialogue where they're explaining something to you through characters talking is like 8 minutes in. Before that, there's just one or two lines of people kind of yelling at each other. You know, in all honesty, dialogue in this movie often conveyed information in more of an emotional sense, especially with George and his friend and his dad on the boat, the civilians. Like, so much of that dialogue was emotional. And this movie, you could watch without dialogue. You could watch this movie muted. It would have less effect because of, like you explained, Aiden, with the music and the sound design, how well it was done. But you'd be watching the same movie in terms of story, especially with the simple information they give you with 1 week, 1 day, you know, 1 hour. You know, that's like all the information you need to be able to tell what was happening in a somewhat complex, for Nolan, not that complex, but a somewhat complex timeline. Samuel, you mentioned how beautiful it was, and it's weird coming back to this movie. This is my third time watching it. I watched it once at home and once in theaters. I think above any movie, definitely in the 20 that we've watched this season, this is the one that I would want to go back and watch in theaters again, because of the entirety of the movie being shot on an IMAX camera, and on IMAX film, large format. It's just beautiful. It's interesting coming back to it and realizing, you know, the Dark Knight trilogy for Nolan is often characterized as like the art film superhero movies, which there's some truth to that, but this truly is among I think all of his movies the closest thing to an art film. And it's so artfully done. A lot of that comes from like the almost experimental nature of just having so little dialogue, but also just the beauty in the beach and just so many of the shots that are just like breathtaking, as the Spitfires, everything. And we go a lot into like the camera because there's so much there. But yeah, I rate this movie pretty highly on the list of movies this season. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. You both, you know, mentioned the dialogue and how he uses it. And then Aiden, you were saying, talking about the sound of the movie, even though there is no dialogue, and without that dialogue, it puts so much more of an emphasis on, you know, the music and the picture and everything else, that it makes it such a more physical experience watching this movie, I think, you know, without that dialogue. And the dialogue they do use or choose to use is so, you know, impactful. Just like that scene where Collins is like, he's on me, and Tom Hardy says, I'm on him. It's so, you know, small. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just a couple little line readings, but they are very, you know, to the point. You get kind of pumped up, and they use it very well. He really picked the spots very well to throw in that dialogue, you know, throughout the film.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting. There's a lot of talk of like Nolan movies, the dialogue not being that discernible. Like famously, obviously, Tom Hardy in The Dark Knight Rises being a bit unable to understand him through his mask. And I think this movie suffers from that a little bit as well. There are times when you're not really sure. I did watch it with subtitles on, but you're totally right. Like, those lines are so effective in not only conveying emotion, like I said, but just the mood and the intensity. And the intensity in this movie is constantly building. Mm-hmm. In a little short documentary I watched about it, they talked with Hans Zimmer about, like, it's not possible to infinitely convey intensity, nor should it necessarily be that way in a movie, but we got as close as you probably can to just constantly ramping intensity. I think of it like climaxing at when Collins, the pilot, is trying to escape from like the flooding of his Spitfire, and that simultaneously is happening with so many other things happening on the beach and on boats and in the air. Yeah, and really great parallel action between these three events that are happening on even separate timelines at times. So, yeah. And that's really well conveyed through the dialogue as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, intensity-wise, there's definitely, like, right out the gate... Oh, whoa, something happened here. There we go. We're good. I think I hit my mute on the call. Okay. Yeah, I think... Like, right out the gate, obviously, title of the film is what's happening, like, where we are. one of the darkest days of World War II before U.S. involvement, pushing English and French to the brink of Europe, essentially having to retreat back to England. And I think right out the gate, every character that we have is given a problem, and that problem... is like carried throughout the film, and there's things that are stacked on top of it throughout the film that sometimes get resolved, and then those lead to other things. One example I think of is Tom Hardy's character in the airplane. Right out the gate, basically, he gets in that fight and his gas gauge breaks, and is not able to tell how much fuel he has in his plane. Is going on the entire film. He's like written stuff down, trying to do calculations, but honestly, like, you can probably never truly calculate that mm-hmm. perfectly, especially having to go up and down in the air and circling around and finding people and stuff. And that was just a constant thing that was happening. And I think another huge theme that was happening in the film was just the cloud of smoke over Dunkirk that you could see from the boats, you could see from the air. Everyone was heading towards it, which is... definitely a theme of bravery. Bravery was a huge thing that was happening throughout the film. And I really like how, you know, it wasn't necessarily people saying that we were headed to Dunkirk. You just saw the cloud of smoke over the horizon, and you knew where they were going and what they were getting themselves into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're right, like, these problems set from the beginning are important, and I think I'll just talk about the opening a bit, because, like, the introduction to the characters is so well done, and I love the introduction to the issue, they don't really explain to you what's happening. They just show it on the pamphlet that's dropped from the sky. They pick up the document from the Axis powers that says you're surrounded. And that's all you need to know for the rest of the movie, is that there's a ticking time bomb. You then have another ticking bomb of, you know, like you said, Ferrier is Tom Hardy's character's name, in the plane, and he has a time limit for when he's going to go down. You also have Tommy, the main character introduced first, who is on a timer to actually get on the boat, or else he's going to be stuck on the beach. So each one of these characters is giving a timer. And that first scene is so impressive, between running through the streets down to the actual beach, past the French barricades. There's something so beautiful about the beach and the way that Nolan Hoyte van Hoytema captured it. It's interesting because Nolan has such a clean design in all of his movies. And I love that that was maintained through like the hectic atmosphere of people trying to exit a beach. There's these clean lines of people, and the military gear is all spread out and knolled in these clean lines, and there's the flagpoles that are used for symmetry. And I think all of that was very well captured and very well shot. The opening and introducing those problems is very effective.
Yeah, and that's, you know, to go off of what both of you said, it's just, even though I guess it really wasn't a battle of Dunkirk, but the Dunkirk, you know, event, like, each character really isn't, it's almost like they're not even concerned about the war at that point. They're just worried about, you know, getting off the beach. Mark Rylance, who's Mr. Dawson, you know, on his, you know, boat, he's worried about kind of managing the chaos from the Cillian Murphy character, you know, making sure they get there and get back, taking care of the boys. Everybody has their own, you know, issue, and everybody has their own personal war, and they're just all trying to focus on, you know, surviving. And like I said at the beginning, even though you may know the results of Dunkirk, by showing kind of the desperation and anxiety of these individual characters, it really, you know, gets you very invested.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love, this is like huge, and it's like the theme of the movie, but the way they so effectively conveyed how each individual character is handling the problems that they're facing. Like, you have some real characters that display real heroism, like Mr. Dawson on the boat, and George, and Peter on the boat, and Ferrier and Collins and the Spitfires. But you have characters like Tommy and Alex, played by Harry Styles, who are a little less heroic, and like the Shivering Soldier, played by Cillian Murphy, who come across as less heroic, but not in a way that you necessarily blame them. There was a lot of intention put into like casting 18 to 21 year old actors to show you, listen, like, these are kids out here expected to fight and like stay composed. And, you know, it was interesting that you really just don't blame them, like, for cheating their way onto the boat and stowing away on the side of the mole and acting like they were dunked by the bombing of the boat and all that stuff. So I thought that was really well done and very interesting.
And shout out Gibson, the Frenchman, for opening up turning the wheel to let everybody out when the boat was sinking, because everybody else was bailing and jumping off, and then he went back to make sure everybody else could get out, and then unfortunately he kind of got a raw deal at the end. But
And then was kept on the drowning boat at the end.
Yeah, and then it's interesting that you say that you wouldn't necessarily blame them for the characters that are a little less heroic, because, you know, not everybody can be Ferrier, who goes back to the beach even though, you know, his gas is, he's out of fuel. But it's interesting because they show the scene of Cillian Murphy where he is dry, he's in charge of that little lifeboat, and he's kind of like, oh, you'll be fine, the water's, you know, not too rough, it's not too cold. But as soon as he's pushed through kind of the crucible of having to be, you know, abandoned it in the ocean, he's flips. But then as soon as he kind of gets his bearings about him, he goes back to kind of, oh, is the boy going to be okay? It kind of goes back and forth so that they're not really villains, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, you don't want, I don't think he wants you to hate Cillian Murphy and just like, wow.
Yeah, there's, and then there's something
different.
Sorry, Sam.
And then I don't think he wants you to hate Harry Styles either, because, you know, like we talked about, it's about survival. And as soon as they had to figure out, when they were in that boat that was rising, who's going to get off so we can float? It was Gibson. Then it was Gibson.
It's New York sounds. I'm
not used to it. It was Gibson. You know, then it was Tommy. And because, you know, they weren't part of their regimental unit. Right. So they were in an instant ready to kick those two out, even though, you know, they weren't, you know, doing anything wrong. They weren't the enemy. But then as soon as, you know, the boat, they had to all bail out, he's like, okay, come on, Gibson, don't worry about it. So each character that's a little less heroic does kind of go back and forth, and you can just tell that some, when put to the metal, weren't able to, stand up to that intensity. You know, yeah. Some, you know, like Ferrier or, you know, Mr. Dawson, Collins, even, you know, Commander Bolton, who's going to stay back and wait for the French, yeah. You know. Those are the ones that were the very, you know, heroic all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've mapped out like a full timeline of the way characters go, and I don't have to get to that yet. Aiden, if you had anything you wanted to add.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I mean, I think I definitely agree. I don't think that we're supposed to hate any of the characters for not being as heroic or, you know, caring about themselves more than others. I think that's like definitely just a war thing. Like, some people have things at home that they want to get home to, and some people have, you know, nothing left, and like this war is all that they have left to fight for. And I think you can see that in some of the characters, and how, you know, how much they're fighting for something and caring about something that's bigger than themselves. I just think it was portrayed accurately. Like, not everyone's going to be, like, not everyone on the war field is going to be this heroic person that, you know, steps out of the boat first to take the shot so everyone else can be saved. And, you know, I just think it was portrayed accurately.
I do have written down, you know, that I think that George, Mr. Dawson, Ferrier, and, what's the commander's name? Commander Bolton.
Bolton. Yeah.
Those are like, I think, the big heroic characters in the film. And I think that you have them, as we talked about, like the Shivering Soldier, Tommy, Alex, come across as less heroic, but it didn't matter either. We talked about like the ways they end up. And I think that it was interesting that Tommy and Alex were delivered by Cillian Murphy, because they would have died on the by the U-boat that bombed them. And in addition, out of chance, Cillian Murphy is sitting on top of his drowned boat, and a boat shows up out of nowhere, and he's rescued. And so you have characters like George, who tragically was injured, like a fluke accident, was killed, just kind of for being a bystander. And additionally, you have Ferrier, who was tragically like delivered into the enemy's hands because he had to come back and save the people on the beach. And Bolton, who stayed behind waiting for the French. You don't know, you know, what happens to him. You just have, you know, these examples of like things don't always end up the way that they should. But you also, I think, see it not. I don't even want to call it karma, because you don't want to see these characters in a bad place. But you do, at the end, see the reverence that they have for Ferrier as he's flying over the beach, and you see the appreciation for the civilian boats, and you see the appreciation for Mr. Dawson. And George does end up in the paper, like he said he always wanted to for his dad's sake. And then you see Alex, Harry Styles, who's ashamed. While he's riding back on the train, he can't even look out the window at the people that are trying to celebrate him, just because of his perception of the way he's acted already, and the way that he thinks that he looks like a failure because of the way he's acted. And with Cillian Murphy, at the end, realizes that George died and disappears into the crowd because he can't face that. Honestly, in a small moment, you have Collins, who Mr. Dawson shakes his hand and said, "Don't worry, we know what you were doing up there. We know the appreciation and the reverence that we should have for you. So you do kind of see a bit of redemption from these more heroic characters and the appreciation that's shown for them, and a bit of more the other characters kind of that come across as less heroic being put in their place a little bit more at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. I think adding on to that, for me personally, I think the biggest heroes for me were the Commander mm-hmm. Bolton, and then Tom Hardy's character. And I thought it was interesting. I'm pretty confident in saying that I think every one of the main characters was an actual Englishman, like actually from England. I don't fact check me on that. I think it's correct, but I'm not 100% sure.
Seems like
But I think it was just interesting. I feel like this is kind of like a heated topic, but I always feel like whenever there's like war films made, and obviously almost, I'm pretty sure every actor in this film was white, a white man, other than like some nurses on the boats that were caring for soldiers. But like, I think obviously it was in England, and I think Nolan was trying to just be historically accurate in doing that. And I think just adding on to that, the fact that he, you know, every actor that was in it was English. I think the attention to detail there, I mean, Harry Styles, like, like that's like so random. But I just like how that was included in there. And I think that really adds to the story. I think, you know, obviously, and like I just said a few minutes ago, in war, you're either fighting to get back home to your family or fighting for yourself or, you know, whatever you're fighting for. Obviously, on this day in Dunkirk, people were just trying to get out of there and trying to save themselves. And I think one of the parts that made Commander Bolton one of the heroic characters was the fact that, yes, he stayed to help and make sure that all of his English soldiers made it out alive, and he was the last person to leave, but very easily could have said, okay, French, you're on your own, sorry. But just the fact that he, you know, the French, he knew that without the French, they weren't going to make it out of the war mm-hmm. either way, especially without U.S. involvement yet. And so staying back for that, definitely a heroic act. And the fact that Tom Hardy's character, he knew he was low on gas, but he turned around to take down a few planes to save some ships towards the end of the film, and comes back over the beach as well, goes a lap there and a lap back, and eventually lands on the beach where I'm pretty sure, if I took it correctly, he was captured by mm-hmm. German forces,
mm-hmm. yes. yeah.
which is like a pretty heroic act. And I thought it was actually interesting that he burned his ship. And I, from what I understood of it, he probably did that just so that the German forces wouldn't steal it and possibly use it to trick.
Yeah, just if there are maps inside, stuff like that, that would give away
yeah.
the position.
Intel, yeah, intel, anything, yeah.
Yeah, so he basically landed it, burned it, and was like writing it in that he was just going to get captured, which is a very, very heroic act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's not gonna. That Tom Hardy scene at the end, where Bolton closes his eyes because he thinks he's about to, you know, get gunned down by
yeah.
you know the German fighter, to where Tom Hardy lands, that makes my eyes a little misty every time.
Yeah,
love that scene. It's yeah. so good. And he's really good in this movie, actually. Just to go off that, you know, his face is covered until the very last scene,
mm-hmm.
Which I think he enjoys doing, yeah. judging it from the roles he picks. His face is always either, you know, covered, or he uses some sort of crazy accent. But anyway, like, there are scenes where just with his eyes, he's, you know, when, like that scene where he's calling after Collins when Collins is having to land on the ocean. He sounds so concerned for him.
Yeah.
And the acting just in his eyes is so, so good. But I agree with you, Aiden, about how just the attention to detail in this, and just how authentic this movie is, I think really goes a long way for me. I was doing some research about it, and Nolan was saying that, you know, and he's not adverse to CGI, but he just, if he can shoot it, he wants to, you know, shoot it any way he can. like, and I was doing some research, and they used cardboard cutouts on the beach instead of, you know, they used tons and tons of extras, but they also used a lot of cardboard cutouts of soldiers to, you know, make it look like, you know, packed guys together. So maybe think of the NBA bubble with cardboard cutouts in the stands. They used that, and then they weren't able to find a British destroyer, like an authentic one that they could have refurbished and used for this film. But so instead of using a CG one, they used a French destroyer that they were able to get, and they kind of spruced it up. He put, you know, cameras on the Spitfires. He had them modified so that he could, you know, shoot in the sky. And it goes a long way, because then if you see a movie where there was a movie about Pearl Harbor that came out like last year, and it was all CG. It just, you know, it's night and day, the two different the films and the differences. So I really admired his attention to detail and the authenticity in this one. It, you know, really makes a difference.
Yeah, and I think we'd be amiss to not talk about Nolan's just craft. Like, a lot of people that have that criticize Nolan that aren't necessarily the biggest fans of his movies always, I think, add, like, but you cannot deny that he's just a filmmaker that is just a craftsman. And it so comes through with this. And a big part of that is just using this IMAX camera and just having such a large visceral frame, and to be able to put real stuff in that instead of CG just makes all the difference. And it's not even doing it justice to say they mounted a camera on a plane, because this IMAX camera is like the size of 3 cinder blocks. It's 70 pounds. It is like insane how big this camera is. And they put it on a plane as if it was a GoPro. And that was what Hoyte van Hoytema said, was we wanted to achieve what a GoPro can achieve, but with something as beautiful as an IMAX camera. They put it in the cockpits. They had special planes with 2 cockpits in them so that they could film the cockpits. They had like rotating lenses so that they could like get the POV of Farrier in the cockpit. I love the shot of the reticle, like, shooting, just how real that seems. It just feels so real.
There's no flash from the...
Yeah, and you can see the flashes of the bullets as they hit planes. Mm-hmm. It's, like, fast and blurry, but somehow you just know when they made contact. There's so much detail. I think of the shot of Tommy laying on the beach in the sand and the explosions happening behind him, which were all real, and there were people, there were extras jumping and like being hit nearly with explosives, and the sand falling on Tommy. It's just so incredible. And I think I also just want to give credit to Hoyte van Hoytema, because it's unheard of to do handheld with an IMAX camera. Again, 70 pounds sitting on your shoulder. There's footage of him in a wetsuit in 3 feet of water holding an IMAX camera, you know, trudging through the water, sitting on the edge of boats. They took an IMAX camera handheld onto Mr. Dawson's boat, that tiny little recreational ship, and just captured such beautiful stuff with this. There was a moment, and just a testament to like how dedicated Nolan is and the crew is, in the case where Colin's plane crashes. They actually launched a plane off of a catapult into water with an IMAX camera attached to it. And the plane sunk in the water, and they lost the camera. And they had to get scuba divers down there and go get it. And they ended up being like, oh, the film actually looks great, cultured with salt water. Like, this worked out for the best. So, they launched planes. They had a pilot attach 2 IMAX cameras and follow planes in the sky. Like, so much skill and craft. There were, I think, 64 ships in the water at one time, holding ships in place, some with cameras on them, some with food on them, some with shelter on them. Just so much went into this movie. It's unbelievable. And that's, you know, you put this movie's budget of 100 to 150 million next to Space Jam's budget of 160 million, and you wonder where all the money's going. So,
it's just
interesting. Yeah.
I was going to mention, last week we talked about how the Tarantino verse tends to recycle actors a little bit, and I really appreciate that with Nolan as well, the Nolan verse. That's not a thing, the Nolan verse. Definitely not a thing. But Tom Hardy's character, mm-hmm. He's in the Batman trilogy. I'm forgetting the other guy's name.
Inception.
Cillian Murphy is in the Batman trilogy as well.
Yep. Yep, that Inception. One as well. There are several actors that show up that I've seen before in Nolan films. Nolan knows what he wants out of his actors. And I think just having that connection with actors and like knowing that they can perform the way that you want them to is definitely a huge factor in making a beautiful film like this. And I think also just having that connection, like, I feel like there's some kind of unspoken communication between a director and an actor that you can just get by having experience with one another. I think just like if I log on to that free service where I can find a random actor to help me out for a few hours on a
backstage,
project,
yeah.
Like
yeah.
The, yeah, backstage, like that chemistry is probably not going to be super good unless like our personalities just as humans kind of match. Mm-hmm. But I think in a professional setting, still, like, I think that matters. And just the fact that Nolan is able to reuse actors and bring out the best in them to get what he wants in a film is just really incredible.
Kenneth Branagh, too, who's Commander Bolton, he was in Tenet. I don't know if he's anything else. And then Michael Caine's in this. He's the voice of Fortis Leader, the one that gets shot down, but you never see him. That's Michael Caine's voice, and he's obviously in a bunch of...
And it's also funny, in 1969, Michael Caine played a pilot in the Royal Air Force in a movie called Battle of Britain. So, you know, he's 50 years ago.
Reprising his role.
Yeah.
No, and you said that, you were saying that, you know, he works with his people and they probably enjoy it and love it. And he's said that's part of why he tries to be so authentic in shooting. Because he said it's more fun for the actors if I can, rather than just, you know, have them in a studio and, you know, green screen behind them and, you know, CG a bunch of stuff. He said, like, for instance, that scene in Inception where the hallway's, you know, turning.
Yeah.
He actually, you know,
all
put
practical.
Something
yeah.
on an axle and they turned it.
Yeah.
The actors seemingly love working with him. So it goes a long way. And, you know, if you have that environment, you know, for your cast, you know, it's probably, you know, a great deal of fun. But yeah, I don't know. We're on Nolan a lot. I love Nolan, the filmmaker. I don't always love his movies, like Inception, Interstellar. I'm not, you know, huge fans of. I've only seen The Prestige once. Obviously, you know, I've worn out the Batman trilogy and this movie, but the other, I'm kind of lukewarm on his movies sometimes, but I really admire, you know, one, like I said, his attention to detail, and two, his patience. They shot this movie at Dunkirk, and mm-hmm. their shooting schedule was dictated by the tides.
Yeah.
So they had to wait around a lot, and he didn't rush it. He took his time, and he said he originally had the idea for this on a voyage crossing the English Channel with his wife back in the 90s, and he really wanted to make this movie, and he said I needed to wait until I had the ability to do something like this. One, because I don't have the experience to do a big action war movie, and two, I want a giant budget, and you know. He didn't have that yet, but he was very patient. You know, he's been turning it over in his mind, you know, for close to 20 years, and you know, it came out, you know, fantastic. So, because I can't imagine how hard it would be to just hold on to an idea, you know, for over 20 years before you can actually, you know, act on it. And one more note on that: he originally wanted to shoot this without a script, just do different timelines and kind of ad-libbed the shooting as he went along, but his brother convinced him that you should probably write a script for this.
Yeah.
So he wrote a 75-page script, which is about as half the length of most of his scripts. Like, his scripts are famously very long.
Yeah.
And very complicated. Like, the original draft for Dark Knight Rises was over 200 pages and was, based off of A Tale of Two Cities. So very, very long and in depth. So, you know, most movies, you know, are, you know, probably
120 pages.
And this one was just 75, and it goes to show you know what he can do even without much dialogue.
And that's kind of I was talking about how it feels more of an art film than most of his movies, and I rented the movie on Amazon. I clicked play and was like, wow, only 140 minutes, or an hour 40 minutes, excuse me. And you know, next to Inception, that's over 2 hours, Tenet's over 2 hours, all three movies of the Dark Knight trilogy. I mean, I feel like Dark Knight Rises is close to three. So, you know, it's concise. It's not overdone. It's dramatic, but it has like earned the spot to be dramatic, which I know Samuel and I were talking about. There are some of his other movies that don't feel like they really have earned the height of drama. Movies like Inception, Interstellar, don't really work as dramatic as they are. But certainly this one does. And I think one more note on like just his type of directing is, it's interesting because there's a clip of him in an interview where he talks about like some compromises he had to make on set, where he doesn't like using CGI, and I think most directors, if they couldn't do something real, they would say, fine, I'll do this. There was a shot of Collins's plane crashing that he wanted to be able to do, like, with Collins in the cockpit going down the water, and he was like, obviously we couldn't do that, so had to compromise, and they built, like, this massive gyro with a cockpit on it where they could, like, spin Collins around and, like, make it look like he was crashing. So it wasn't even a compromise. They still had a model plane that they were out on the beach, you know, launching around and getting footage of. But he really pays such a detail, and I don't think you get something this polished and something this effective emotionally, like, without that attention to detail and this visceral. It's nothing feels as real as this real thing, especially shot on IMAX, and it just came out so perfectly, I think.
And also his confidence to leave it at an hour and 40 or 45 minutes.
That's, you know, it's hard to do as well.
It's very rare that, I can't really think, I'm sure there are, but I can't really think of like a big war epic that's under 2 hours. It's not uncommon to see war movies go 2 to 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, because there's so much build up. And but he just really, you know, was concise and, you know, really narrow in his focus and, you know, got it done in an hour and 40. Yeah,
I think additionally, going off of that, the fact that this is like a terrible day in World War II, like the fact that it's able to be concise in an hour and 45 minutes, and also that it's able to, like, at the end of the film, you feel a little bit of relief and like a little bit of happiness that, you know, they were able to rescue, I think it was 330,000 people from the shores of Dunkirk. And like, obviously, very bad day that they had to just like straight up leave England because German forces were so strong pushing them that far. But just the fact that you're able to feel that sense of relief at the end of the film after an hour and 45 minutes, nonetheless, just really well done.
Yeah. Yeah. I know I'm talking a lot about the IMAX camera, but there's just some more stuff that's just so incredible that they did. It's worth noting that they had underwater shots with an IMAX camera. It's like an underwater rig for a DSLR my size cost like $2,000, and like to have confidence that you're like waterproofing an IMAX camera and putting it underwater. Obviously they're professionals, they know what they're doing, but still having an underwater shot with such a camera is pretty unheard of. And there's something from Interstellar that I'm pulling from. They have these beautiful like portraits that they accomplish with an IMAX camera because it's large format. You're able to just get, without having a wide angle lens, just this beautiful large portrait of people's faces, which they do a lot with Matthew McConaughey. They do that here as well. There's just some beautiful shots in the cockpits of Ferrier and Collins. My favorite shot, I think, in cinema is the last shot of Tom Hardy right before he's pulled away. Shows his flaming ship, and then the shot of his face with the sunset behind him, and just it, there's some blur, there's some distortion from the lens, but it's this massive portrait due to the use of IMAX, and it's just so impressive. And that shot gets me every time. There was really beautiful use of shallow depth of field, especially in the scene of they're all eating bread and jam on the boat. And you have this massive crowd of guys, but as they move this camera through the crowd in tight spaces, the focus always remains so tightly on Tommy and Alex. And picks them out of the crowd in a group of guys that all look identical. They have the same haircut, they're wearing the same uniform, and the shallow depth of field really helps to draw that out. So really just some beautiful camera work. The color, beautiful. We talked on the Ocean's 11 week a lot about like the use of oranges in movies. This is like the quintessential use of teal and yellow. It's like, it's known to be beautiful, and oftentimes it can be overdone. But there's a few movies, the two that stick out to me are Sicario and this movie, that just so beautifully use natural tones. The blue sometimes comes out in their hair, even just the beach and the sun, the oil lamps that they have. It's just all super well done, and super beautifully colored. But yeah, that's the extent to my cinematography notes. So I'm done now. Talk about IMAX.
you the nerd, always talking about the cinema.
Need to see it in person.
Yeah, I think like additionally, just a thought that I had on that, like. Obviously waterproofing that and doing that cinema cam, but just curious, like I'm not expecting either of you to know this off the top of your head, but I'm just wondering, like, we know that Christopher Nolan is huge for wanting to do this stuff himself with the explosives, the, you know, whatever, like the real planes, the real ships, et cetera, et cetera. I'm curious, like, how much of it, how much of that budget, the $150 million budget, goes into cinematography or like set design versus CGI as compared to like a normal movie, like a normal war film, if that makes sense, like not directed by Christopher Nolan.
Well, you think about, you know, you're paying different people, right? So in this case, you're paying a ton of money to production designers who, by the way, built the mole. The mole wasn't there. They had to, it doesn't look the same. They had to rebuild it up, and it was basically made of wood and styrofoam and all different things, and it was constantly being broken by the violent waves at the beach. And so you're paying different people, you know, on a set of your typical action movie or typical war movie. You throw up a green screen curtain, which costs some money, and you hire a visual effects supervisor, and, you know, you're hiring the guys that are sitting at desks for thousands of hours doing your visual effects. You know, that's expensive too. That's really a lot of the money of a Marvel movie goes to that, you know. You're not, and talent, yeah, obviously, but, you know, you are, like, for instance, this movie, you're paying a lot more to have 60 boats in the water than you are on a typical set. You're paying more to have, yeah, custom planes built, and again, the mole, and all the labor that goes into that. So it's like the expenses are just reallocated, and yeah. I don't know that it's like a one-to-one ratio of money, because VFX can get crazy expensive, but yeah, it's just a different story.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know, Samuel, anything?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really have any more. I don't have any IMAX notes. I mean,
No, I'm not asking for that. No,
but I think it's a very impressive movie as far as a filmmaker, like, having such a clear vision for what he wants to do and then executing it in, you know, in the script and then in, you know, on camera. He said that when he went into this project, even before he started writing, he approached it in a very kind of mathematical way. And he used music, he said. He said there's something called a shepherd tone, basically, where it's basically several tones separated by an octave, and two climb and one falls. So your brain thinks you're hearing ascending a tone the entire time, whereas it's actually partially, you know, lowering.
Going down a partial, yeah.
And he said he wanted to figure out how he could translate that to writing, and he wanted to use three convergent storylines that seemed to be funneling forward the entire, you know, story. And that, you know, comes out perfectly. And then he's had Hans Zimmer work on a score that, you know, had the same effect. And it actually, I think I read that they're actually, the ticking of the clock goes the entire film.
Yeah.
It gets faint sometimes and it gets real loud sometimes, but it's the entire time. So like I mentioned earlier, he really has, you know, a grasp on your heart rate and kind of, you know, controls it the entire hour and 45 minutes. And it just has, both with the screenplay and the music, it just has the effect of, you know, the rising tension really propels the story forward until the very last minute, whether, you know, it's a, you know, a fast, you know, moment or a slow moment, or, you know, it's real loud, you know, or it's more quiet. You know, it's always moving forward. You mentioned earlier, everybody has their own ticking time clock. Same thing with the movie. It seems like the whole thing is on, you know, a stopwatch, and, you know, it's kind of a sprint from start to finish. You know, I think I paused this once, like three quarters of the way through. I'm like, oh, wow, it's almost over already. Mm-hmm. And, it's just that first shot, you know, the clock starts, you know, through when it ends, when there's that last shot of, you know, Ferrier, and then, you know, what's going on back home in England. And then, you know, that's it. That was his vision all the way through, and he executed it, you know, to perfection.
Yeah. Yeah. And that bit of musical theory is interesting in it. And I guess I can't like dissect it and know exactly how that works, but I think it is a testament to it working based on the fact that with this complicated storyline, you see the titles of 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour, and you like never really think about it. Sometimes you say, oh, this is some point in that week on the beach. But the way that the stories converge on each other is just so flawlessly done, because you never really have to think, oh, wait, when is this happening? And that's perfect, like that you really never have to think about it. And it's surprising that you never have to think about it.
You really don't think about it till towards the end, when you start to kind of hear repeat dialogue.
Right.
You know, there's a couple times where I think it's Collins maybe says something that he said earlier. Like if they show Collins going down, and earlier you see it from Tom Hardy's perspective.
You heard Ferrier saying,
yeah,
are you okay?
Exactly.
You read me? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's when it kind of triggers, even if you were conscious of the way the story was going, it's really a test to him, because he's played with that before in other movies, you know, the cross cutting among storylines, like in The Dark Knight, you know, when they're going for Two-Face and then Rachel. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of converging storylines. And then in Inception, of course. But here he did it for an entire movie and really, you know, pulled it off, which is so impressive.
I think that I also will just say, like, in converging storylines, he doesn't overdo the convention of, you know, having characters pop up and, like, seeing a character from a different point of view. But when he does so, it's really smart. I love seeing Cillian Murphy not allow Tom and Alex onto the boat, because that really matters thematically, like we talked about earlier. But the moment, the duality with Collins waving out of the cockpit, in the first instance it happens from Tom Hardy's point of view, it's a hopeful, quiet moment where you get a relaxing moment for a second, and that happens later, and it's him trying to break out of the cockpit because he's drowning. And like these two moments, you just say, oh my gosh, and like your heart kind of sinks for a minute, and it's crazy that the exact same moment in time can be so relaxing in one moment and so tense in another. And it's just a great lesson on point of view and how much it can matter in storytelling, which is something we talked about a lot with Tarantino, and how the point of view matters a lot in certain elements of that story. So that's super well done on that aspect.
Yeah, I was gonna add, I think I was very confused at the beginning with the title cards. I've never seen this film before. That was like my first note. I was like, what does this mean?
same when I first watched it.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, probably like half an hour in, I figured out, I was like, oh, okay, all of these things are happening like for us at the same time, but for them, like on the ground, it's one day. And for the boat, it's like, or like 1 hour on the beach, and then for the boat, obviously it takes 1 day to travel from England to the mainland of Europe, and then for the planes, whatever, it's like
1 hour.
The planes is a day, the boat is a week, probably,
or the beach is a week, the boat's a day, the plane's an hour.
whatever doesn't matter I was a little confused at that. I figured it out eventually. And I think honestly the point where I probably like realized it and appreciated it was the scene where we see the plane crash for the second time from the second point of view. And I remember thinking, I was like, oh, that like that's so brilliant. Like not only are the characters that we see from these three different like points in time starting to come together, but we're able to see like just what those title cards mean and like what they tell us and how like how it feels in the present for us, but at the same time, the boat has been like on the water for quite some time, and the plane, you know, we've experienced it for the same amount of time, but the plane has been in the air much like a shorter amount of time than the boat. And I think, like we've mentioned, a classic Christopher Nolan thing to converge and mix up timelines, but really, really brilliantly done. It's just a touch confusing, but you know, we figured it out, we've overcome it, and it's all good.
It definitely took me, I think, like the first time I watched it, I honestly couldn't focus on all of it, whether it was the timelines or how beautiful it was or the performances. There was so much going on, and then it's over. It took me the second full watch through to really kind of, you know, pick up on everything. And then one thing that just kind of came to mind is, for how kind of bleak and harsh this movie is at times, it does have a surprising amount of heart, which is kind of not always, I don't think, Nolan's strong suit. We talked about it earlier with the admiration that everybody has for Tom Hardy whenever he's, when Ferrier is crossing over the beach at the end. But then we haven't talked about him a lot, but Mr. Dawson, the Mark Rylance character, it's really kind of the citizens and him in particular, their story is very touching. It's, he has all this knowledge about, you know, the planes and the Spitfires and the Rolls Royce engine and, you know, how to evade them. You kind of wonder how, and then you realize it's because his son was in the RAF and he was killed in combat. And he has that line about how men his age dictate the war. Why should we be able to send our sons into it, but we can't help?
Yeah.
And so like that boat, his boat was his own war and his own battle. And whether it was balancing the chaos between Cillian Murphy and is it George and
Peter,
the other
George
Peter,
and Peter,
or whether it's trying to pack as many soldiers on or trying to evade the fighter, he really kind of has his moment. And that's kind of, he's kind of the, I found to be the heart of the movie, because he's, you know, the representation of, you know, Britain, of home.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think kind of going off of that, I wanted to mention that there was historically on the beach for that week just a lot of like, where's the Royal Air Force? Like, why aren't they helping? And what's important to note, and I think that Nolan doesn't talk about this in the movie explicitly, but is why the character Ferrier is so important, and why that last moment of him coming back in for the Spitfire and then sacrificing himself is so important, and you have everyone clapping for him. And then the moment of Collins being jeered at when they get off the boat, and then Dawson saying, no, we appreciate you, is important, because you did have all these soldiers dogging the Air Force, when in reality the Air Force was the reason that there weren't way more bombers coming to the beach. The Air Force had already taken out like a ton of the bombers, and the ones that were threatening the beach were the ones that had just slipped through. And then you have characters like Ferrier and Collins who are there to clean up. But I think that's important to know, and a part of the history that comes through in the movie, definitely, without explicitly talking about it. I also, because you're on the podcast, Samuel, I wanted to talk about a couple of things, I guess, relevant to us. We recently shot a short film on the beach, and I did some camera work with an iPhone in the ocean. Wasn't even as deep as Hoytema was, probably, you know, it's a few grams compared to 70 pounds, and I was struggling to like get good shots in the ocean, so just I commend that. Sorry,
this is tough.
Props.
And I also want to talk about, and I'm sure there's plenty of moments like this throughout the film, but the moment of the trains in the middle of the countryside and they roll up on kids throwing rocks at a train car. And it's just kind of this symbol of like youth and like carefree. They're not that much younger than the guys on the train who were just at war by probably a decade. And, you know, but it was reminiscent of like the bullets hitting the boat that they were sitting in, and they were drowning. And then you have these kids just like playing around throwing rocks at this piece of metal. And it was just a meaningful interaction, all to just get Alex a newspaper that he can read. And I Samuel and I were sitting down writing a script the other day, and you know, sitting there trying to think of something meaningful that a character at a desk could be doing. And the scene was okay. I think it was a good scene. We were proud of it. But there's just so much genius and so much heart that goes into these small moments of a script and stuff that just makes you think and stuff that just... He could have said, hey, kid, give me a paper, but there's so much more meaning behind that.
It makes me think we need to rewrite now, just thinking about it. Well,
absolutely. But when you sit and you think about a movie for 20 years, yeah, I think that's what happens. And
it's like that, what you're scene saying, too, really. That scene, too, is so interesting because it's so beautiful there and so serene, and there's just an obliviousness amongst those children. And, like, Commander Bolton literally says it earlier. You can almost see it from here. Like, they're so close to where the action just was. And it's like a completely different world from, you know, the shores of Dunkirk, you know, to, you know, where that train, that station they're pulling into. It's just, and it is meaningful like that, because there aren't a lot of scenes that cut away from just the soldiers on the beach or Farrier in the sky or Rylance. That's it. It's just those three sequences or these three storylines. It's so just using that at the end just shows the importance of what he was trying to convey. Like, if you think about it, there are no scenes where there's, like, generals plotting. They don't really even show the enemy other than, you know, the fighters in the air, which you can even see the actual, the guys in the cockpit. It's, and I think that in compared to other war movies, there's always at least one scene of, like, generals moving around flags on a board or the enemy, you know, saying, you know, we've got him on the run or something. It's, there's always a little, you know, something like that to give context, but there's none of that in this. And I think that really helps to convey like the isolation, the loneliness that each of these soldiers must have felt on the beach. Like, there's that, the politics of war is just out of sight, out of mind. They don't, those guys on the beach probably didn't know, like you were saying, they're wondering, where's the RAF? They're probably also wondering, is there a plan to get us off the beach? Like, they're just going to leave us here? Are we all going to die? So with the absence of any other sort of storyline, it really goes to show it.
It's, I think also, I think like, also like adds to the idea of, you know, because they're so close to home, but yet it's so different from these kids playing and just this place of like that represents seemingly like serenity. Again, it goes back to, like, you can't blame these guys for acting the way they do, and you don't want to blame them for it at the end. It's like they're in an environment so close to home and yet so different, and something that you can't really even imagine. So I just found that really effective, yeah.
Yeah, I think even going off what you just said, Sam, I mean, they, some of the other, I don't know what the rank under commander is, the other leaders of the military that were on the end of the dock with
that colonel that was there.
They like, they didn't even know that the small boat, the small boats were coming. Like it was a surprise, like Commander Bolton had called that in and they were coming. And even the other ranking officers just had no idea. Like, they were oblivious to the fact that anyone was coming to rescue them. Boats continued to sink, like right there on the shores. And I think, just to add that to your point. But I wanted to add something else. I talked about it briefly earlier. But just the soundtrack in general, Hans Zimmer is just an absolute genius, composer. But I, you know, it sounds like there's music playing the entire film. And if there isn't, then it's just beautiful sound editing that really gives you detail to what's going on. And I, one thing I loved was just how much it cut in between the different parts of the story, and the music like kept going without a hitch. Like, there's no change in the tempo. There's no change in that. Like, there were several instances I noticed where even the notes like wouldn't change. Like, it was really just like a song playing, and that was like, we were just putting the video clips over it. And it was really well done. Intensity, I mean, very, very well portrayed through the music itself. Just a huge Hans Zimmer fan. What a guy.
Yeah. Any more notes? It's funny. I was telling Samuel, I had a professor that said, quote, Hans Zimmer has ruined more movies than he's helped. Which Whoa. I don't necessarily agree with. I really oh don't agree gosh. With. But it was just like, why so opinionated about a composer? Like, it's so strange.
I mean, you two have said, Interstellar is like a good movie. It's not like one of your favorites, not one of your Nolan favorites. I'll say that I like it quite a bit. It's definitely not like a favorite film for me, but I think that even in that, I mean, the Hans Zimmer soundtrack in that film is really elite, as some would say.
Samuel, any notes about Hans?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen Inception like once, maybe since the first time I ever saw it. Okay. But I will listen to that soundtrack a lot, like whether
totally.
I'm, you know, just writing or need something other than just, you know, lyrics in my ear. And so, because when, you know, often if I write, if I listen to something with lyrics or a podcast, I just listen to that. But if I listen to a soundtrack, it's a little bit easier. And I love listening to, you know, his soundtrack. So he's a real winner of this movie for me. And one last thing on Nolan. You guys talked about Tarantino last week. There was an interview that Tarantino gave where he said that he thought that Dunkirk was like Nolan's like big, you know, introduction to being like one of the big boy directors, essentially, because it was a breakaway from the comic book movies he had done. And all of his stories are pretty much original, which is great, but this one kind of nailed every category across the board, you know, the style, the tone, the story. It would, like you said earlier, Michael, it was worthy of its, you know, its serious demeanor as a film. And, he also was able to get people to care and go to a movie about a historical event, and it made over, you know, $500 million.
Yeah.
And, you know, but at the same time, also he was nominated for his first, you know, Academy Award as a director. So, excited for what he did next was Tenet, and that kind of fell flat because of the pandemic. But, you know, excited for what he does in the future, you know, even though I don't always love his movies, he is one of my favorites.
Yeah, at Big Good Film School, he gets a bad rap, like really does. You know, you can't walk around saying your favorite director is Chris Nolan because of like Inception and Interstellar, I think. And because these are just such popular, good movies. It's like everyone's favorite. It's so commercial and it's pretty good, you know. But what Tarantino said about that, I agree with. It's like, it is quite the feat to get people to go see a movie like this.
Yeah.
And it's so set apart from his other movies. And, you know, it is interesting that he didn't really have that level of clout that Tarantino gave him with the Dark Knight movies, because they did something so crazy and new with superhero movies, else, and still there's really nothing else like them in the superhero world. But I hope he continues to make stuff along the lines of Dunkirk.
It's really, you know, hard to knock him. I mean, he literally changed the way the Oscars viewed superhero movies, because that year that Dark Knight came out, a lot of people thought it should have been nominated for Best Picture, but that was, you know, during the era where they still only had 5 Best Picture nominees a year. And it was the following year they expanded the field to 10, because there was so much of an outcry that, you know, Dark Knight had been left out of the top 5. So he's, you know, been a trailblazer in a lot of ways. You know, his movies are always original. Whether or not you like them is, you know, a different story, but he has been kind of one of the premier people the last 20 years. All of his movies, you know, are different. They feel like an event, you know, whenever one of a Nolan movie comes out, you know, people are going to be there. So props to him.
Yeah. I did want to add one last time. I do enjoy Christopher Nolan as a director. I think I've definitely been more exposed to him, through the pod and just like in the past couple years in general. And like it's also really cool just to see, you know, a director is, you know, as popular as Tarantino, kind of like welcoming him to like, oh, like welcome to the good director club. Like, not everyone makes it here, and like I acknowledge you as, you know, being good. But I think in this movie, I wrote down that it doesn't even feel like a movie. Like, it's a journey, and it's like you know, I've said it before, it's just so flawlessly put together and just really great. But that's all I have. So
I will add just one more thing of, you know, he is like just a tier under Tarantino in terms of like, they both do like all their original stuff. They both kind of do what they want, you know, and not a lot of people, you know, tell them what they can and can't do. But yeah, just because of like the reputation and way they were received by fans, it's, you know, he isn't quite in that space, but I don't know. He's got a lot of life left, you know, he's relatively young.
50,
Yeah. And so, I don't know. Well, thank you, Samuel, for coming on.
Thank you,
really
guys.
Enjoyed
yeah.
having you on.
It was a lot of fun. I love the pod. It was great to be on. I loved it.
Awesome. It's motivating to have guests on, both you and Cole, like just added to the conversation. Definitely going to try to continue to do it next season. But yeah, go ahead. And
Wow. End of a road, man. End of
I know.
A,
crazy.
A road. It's crazy. 20 episodes. We've made it. And we're going to have one more recap episode. Michael and I haven't decided if it's going to be next Tuesday or if it's going to be the following Tuesday or whenever mm-hmm. it'll be. But be on the lookout just for that. It'll just be a shorter, fun episode just for us to kind of recap and wrap everything up and kind of, I guess, celebrate our achievement of a really long season. So
yeah. Yeah, 20 weeks long, which is weird to think about. So thank you guys so much. Thank you for your support. It means everything. It's really motivating to do this for 20 weeks and just have fun with it. Thank you again, Samuel, for coming on. And we'll see you in the coming weeks for the last episode.
Peace.